David and Ann, it's been a pleasure having you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, yeah, it's been a real blast. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Alex Smith reporting.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The goals of the KBOO Artist Support Program are to support and invest in individuals who are pushing themselves artistically using sound, whose work will impact the cultural landscape of Portland, and to bring those artists into the dynamic KBOO community of local, national, and international artists and activists. Applications for the 2016 KBOO Artist in Residence are due February 12th at 5 p.m. More information and application materials are at kboo.fm/AIR2016.
And it is 11 a.m. You do have it tuned to KBOO Portland, and coming right up will be Health Watch. Today, Dr. David Naiman's guest is Harriet Washington. They will talk about her book, Infectious Madness, The Surprising Science of How We Catch Mental Illness. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, host Will Hall speaks with Leah Harris, psychiatric abuse survivor and organizer in the Campaign for Real Change in Mental Health Policy, about the Murphy Bill, which proposes some controversial changes in mental health policy. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in 2015. You keep this station on the air.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Nacho Drone, showing Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Released in 1993, Lacho Drum is a French documentary about the Romani people's journey from northwest India to Spain, consisting primarily of music. Again, that's Lacho Drum, Thursday, January 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, and medical eye care, as well as eyewear from independent designers. Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at eyepdx.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Is it possible that some people catch mental illness? In other words, could some significant subset of people with schizophrenia, bipolar, anorexia, OCD, or depression have the cause of their mental illness traced back to an infectious disease, a virus, a bacteria, or a parasite? Today's guest, Harriet Washington, thinks so. A medical ethicist and writer, Harriet Washington is a Shearing Fellow at the University of Nevada's Black Mountain Institute, a former research fellow in medical ethics at Harvard Medical School, and the author of Medical Apartheid, which won the 2007 National Book Critics Circle Award. She's here today on Health Watch to talk about her latest book, Infectious Madness, The Surprising Science of How We Catch Mental Illness. Welcome to Health Watch, Harriet Washington.
Thank you so much, David. I'm very pleased to be here.
So why don't we just start with how you started on this path of investigating a relationship between infections and an increased risk of mental illness?
Well, initially it was sheer serendipity. One thing happened a very long time ago, but it always stuck in my mind. I had encountered a patient on the floor who was mentally ill, clearly. In fact, he was dramatically, had dramatic brain damage, devastating neurological symptoms that culminated in eventually being confined to bed. But he had lost his memory. He couldn't no longer speak. And it turned out, according to the lore from the aides who carried for them, they said, well, this is a man who had paresis. And I didn't think there were any paresis sufferers left. Paresis used to be a very common mental disorder. And it's not common anymore because at one point it was discovered that it was caused by syphilis. We don't see paresis in this country anymore because people with syphilis are now treated with penicillin before they can it can develop to the stage where paresis develops. In the developing world, though, paresis is very common. So I always remembered that, and then I came across an Italian medical journal article in which a researcher tried to link Borna virus, which is more common in Central Europe than it is here, to schizophrenia. And I thought, oh, I've heard of this before, mental illnesses being traced to infection. Then I began thinking about more common or more familiar mental illnesses that we know are caused by infection, like rabies, for example. And it struck me that we actually have knowledge of these diseases, but we don't tend to approach them in this way. We simply don't think of them as diseases caused by infection, but some of them have been familiar to us for a while, and others, the evidence is just now evolving from human studies.
Well, it's interesting that you, in the infectious madness, talk to a variety of experts, and there seems to be some general agreement that perhaps 10 to 15% of mental illnesses are caused by an infectious agent. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And with one very eminent, outsider, there's one outlier. One person thinks that up to 85% of certain illnesses are caused by infection. But he's the outlier. Everybody else agreed on that figure. However, trying to pin them down was fruitless. I kept trying to ask them, well, how do you know this? You know, what studies point to this? But when they supplied studies, they were all over the place because, of course, the studies varied very differently in their methodology and in the disease they looked at and in their recruitment. So there was no real way of comparing these studies. And so I thought, then why are you all independently coming up with 10 to 15%? And finally they began admitting it's just our judgment. You know, it's basically an educated guess, but an educated guess based on decades sometimes of looking at these diseases and teasing out in many studies what the prevalence of infection was.
Well, you mentioned schizophrenia and possible exposure to a virus increasing the risk of it. You also talk about how pregnant women, when they get the flu, their offspring have an increased risk of schizophrenia, and likewise, there may be an increased risk of schizophrenia if you're exposed to Toxoplasma, the parasite in cats. Are all of these pathways just different pathways to the same result, or is there a different mechanism that happens with each of them that might lead to an elevated risk of schizophrenia, for instance?
For schizophrenia, well, it depends on the disorder. For schizophrenia, it seems to be, as you stated, the mechanism rather than a specific agent. Not all infectious agents have been tied to schizophrenia, but a large number have. The common flu, Toxoplasma gondii, a parasite carried by common house cats. Even herpes simplex is tied to an increased prevalence of schizophrenia in pregnant women. So it seems to be what the virus does to the bodies of the woman and her child, rather than any specific action of the virus or the infective agent. Now, in other diseases, that seems not to be the case because, you know, some viruses, some bacteria, and even, you know, other pathogens, sometimes they target particular areas of the body, and some target the brain. So sometimes, depending on the illness, it is indeed a particular infective agent, and in other cases, like schizophrenia, it seems to be how it affects the immune system. You know, when the mother is infected, there is a vigorous immune response, but a fetus in utero doesn't have much protection against it, and it actually may be harmed by the mother's antigens, by the mother's immune response, rather than by the directly by the agent itself. That's something that is still being looked at. They haven't come to a determination on that. There's no agreement there.
But the majority of people in general of having an increased risk of mental illness from an infectious agent are young children, infants, and fetuses versus fully developed adults. Is that because of the still developing central nervous system in younger people?
Yes, and also because of the still-developing immune system. When you look at younger people, toddlers, for example, infants, definitely fetus in utero, you're looking at immune system that sometimes has a very strong response, but the immune system cells have not yet been trained to differentiate between an enemy attacker. And so you have a florid response that could end up injuring parts of the child's own brain. And yes, that's more likely to happen with people with a compromised immune system, including that of the very young. The other end of the spectrum, though, is that in the elderly, you have people whose immune systems are changing dramatically and winding down with age. So there are cases in which they, too, can be particularly vulnerable. But the difference is when you have damage to the system of a young child, you can cause subtle changes that don't manifest themselves for years, as schizophrenia does. There's a chance that schizophrenics who tend to be diagnosed in very late adolescence, early adulthood, this could be a result of brain damage that happened when they were toddlers. But with the elderly, you already have an intact nervous system, so it will affect them differently. It's more time limited. It's not likely to result in, you know, the kind of, you know, global problems that you're going to see in a very young kid whose brain has been, you know, has perhaps been damaged by, you know, early assaults.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Harriet Washington about her latest book, Infectious Madness, The Surprising Science of How We Catch Mental Illness. Harriet, you talk about a syndrome called PANDAS in Infectious Madness, which is controversial, but also leading to some potentially interesting insights about a variety of illnesses. Can you talk to us a little bit about PANDAS, what it is,
and sure,
what the controversy is?
Well, you know, it's controversial, but the controversy is always an interesting word. Most new paradigms, most new theories, they're new. They're certainly not refined, and they're not generally accepted. I mean, that's expected. That's the way science works. So in that sense, it's controversial. It's not controversial in the sense that the science is alleged to be poor or somehow suspect. The theory behind PANDAS is that the very common group A streptococcal infections that a lot of us get, strep throat is probably the most familiar one, when they attack young children, or, you know, even older adolescents, but when they attack young people, their, as I said, their brains and nervous systems are not yet fully developed. So they will have a florid response trying to get rid of this pathogen, trying to quell this infection, but the strong response sometimes results in injuring parts of the child's own nervous system. And that's the theory behind PANDAS, that when children have repeated sore throats, for example, strep throats, the antibodies will actually damage part of the child's nervous system, and as a result, the child develops almost overnight diseases like obsessive compulsive disorder, Tourette syndrome, even anorexia. And there are several hallmarks that differentiate between children who develop these conditions on their own, like most children do. You know, most cases of Tourette are not due to PANDAS. In fact, PANDAS is supposed to be invoked only when you have a case of OCD or Tourette's or anorexia that you cannot explain via the normal etiology. So it's only considered in those cases where a normal course of events would not explain it. And again, one of the hallmarks is that it happens overnight. You don't see that in normal cases of Tourette's, for example. But when you have a child who has been shown no symptoms of mental illness, and over a very short space of time, he begins exhibiting pronounced OCD symptoms. They tend to regress also in other ways. Children who have been acting appropriately for their age will seem to revert to being toddlers. Even their fine motor skills, their handwriting will deteriorate. And these are not normally hallmarks of these disorders. That's when the scientists will suspect PANDAS. And again, you know, it's a result of what I call friendly fire. Your immune system is overreacting, or perhaps just reacting very inaccurately, and it ends up doing more damage to your own nervous system than it does to the pathogen that it's trying to rout.
Well, I'm sure we have listeners who are concerned hearing this with such common conditions like the flu and strep throat, potentially in some minority of cases leading to mental illness. what are some of the things that people can do, if anything? Are there some treatments or prevention strategies?
They feel that can be done. In fact, I always stress that, of course, it sounds scary, but from my vantage point, this is actually a good thing when you consider that for some common devastating mental disorders like schizophrenia, in most cases, we don't know what's caused it, so we can't try to prevent it. And most people with schizophrenia do not get appropriate treatment. Actually, it's probably fairer to say close to half the people in this country who have schizophrenia don't get adequate treatment. And there is, of course, no cure, certainly no prevention. So now we're talking about something for which we may have preventive steps, and that's a good thing. So, and they're simple. The same things mom told you to do to avoid infection, those are the things that are very important here. If it seems to be, that influenza is indeed an important trigger, then getting an annual flu shot becomes even that much more important. We have a vaccine against the flu. Also, things like, and we need to use it, also very simple public health preventative steps that everyone knows that we should do and we don't always do. Wash our hands carefully, especially before preparing food, because not only the influenza virus, but toxoplasma and some other pathogens that are linked to mental illness are caused by tainted food. They can easily taint food, and if it's not cooked correctly, and if you don't wash your hands before preparing food, then you can fall victim to them. So, you know, washing your hands, getting your flu shot, taking steps to, you know, minimize your contact with infection and infectious people. And, of course, I talk in the book about more profound things that we can do. For example, hospital redesign is something people are already looking at. You know, when infectious diseases were rampant and we had no antibiotics, there's a lot of attention paid to designing hospitals in ways to try to minimize exposure, having negative airflow, things like that. And these are all things that we have already begun to revisit, and we should do so vigorously. So the bottom line is a lot can be done, and although there is not a vaccine or not treatment for a lot of these infections, the reality is sometimes prevention is even more important than treatment. Because even if we could treat, say, Toxoplasma gondii, the fact is the damage might already be done. By the time you acquire the illness and get sick, even if you have a treatment, your neurons might already be damaged. So preventing them can in some ways be better than treating it.
Well, one of the other things that I really enjoyed about infectious madness is the sort of interrogation of the mind-body duality. There's, with this growing sense of a relationship between infectious disease and mental illness and between viruses and bacteria and parasites and human behavior, it kind of points to this mind-body model in contemporary medicine being outdated. Can you talk a little bit further about that?
Certainly. You know, it's very interesting. It's very easy when you look at history of medicine and when you look at medical theory, it's very easy to confuse medical facts with habits of thought. And in large part, this dividing line between the mind and the body is a habit of thought. There isn't a lot of good science to support it. And increasingly, we're learning more and more about diseases that carry characteristics of both damage to the mind and damage to the body. I really don't think it's unusual that mental illness should be a result of infection, because it's not unusual for pathogens to cause diseases that have both psychological and physical symptoms. It's just that we tend to focus on one to the exclusion of the other. So this regimentation of diseases into either mental or physical is largely a fiction. And I think at one point, I talk in the book about the political uses of it. Doctors found it very useful during the period when they were trying to take over control of asylums from religious groups, because they wanted to establish that this was a medical model, something that only they had expertise in. And so it was very useful to say these diseases are definitely physical. But, you know, there's also just, again, a long habit of thought that we really need to abandon. Some cultures have not had this. Some cultures have always recognized the duality here. And I think that the clearer we are, the more rigorous we are in determining when something is not only physical or mental, but both, the better off we will be. You know, it's not always binary. You don't always have to choose. And when we recognize the the psychological and mental as well as the physical costs of some illnesses, I think we're going to do a much better job of addressing them, both in terms of prevention and in terms of treatment.
Well, even if we put aside the issue of infectious disease and mental illness, there are many physical diseases that cause mental symptoms, like low thyroid causing depression or asthma often being associated with anxiety, that it seems like we're ignoring that there's quite a spectrum and bleed over from mental to physical in many, many conditions.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true.
You've also written about the research on tropical diseases and how they've undermined intellectual development in countries with poor health care, and I would imagine that might even have some relevance in the United States in areas where people don't have the same quality of health care as in other areas, what you call neglected tropical diseases.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Yes, it has a great deal of relevance in the United States, and especially because this is another case of habits of thought. We call these tropical diseases, and indeed, they're most visible in developing countries. But the reality is, in my article for the American Scholar, in which I discuss this, the reality is the U.S. has a climate, parts of the U.S. has a climate very near the climate of the countries where these diseases are rampant. And now we're seeing these diseases in the U.S. because of our climate. It's very hot and it's getting warmer. And so now we're seeing these diseases that we've always thought of as these exotic tropical diseases. In Texas is now the epicenter for something called Chagas disease, a horrible disease. The schistosomiasis, a whole bevy of these diseases that we've only thought about as happening in the tropics, but we're actually seeing them in warm parts of the U.S., and we're going to see them more and more. After Hurricane Katrina, there's a prevalence of snails that carry a disease called schistosomiasis, which doctors at first were, in denial about. They said people in the U.S. don't get this disease, but they were seeing it everywhere. So these are diseases that threaten all of us, and the medical interdependence, I think, is really important. Unfortunately, I hate to even say this, but because we now are seeing these diseases in the U.S., I think it is going to drive an increased urgency, and we're going to look a little harder for cures and treatments and preventive aspects, and that will be good for us in the U.S., and it will also be good for people in the developing world.
Well, it seems like it is. These are conditions that are going to disproportionately affect people of lower income and people of color, I would imagine.
Yes, in large part, because, on the one hand, we think of pathogens as being democratic, right? You don't think of infections as targeting poor people or people of color, but in reality they do. And they're not sure exactly all the reasons why this is so, but some of the reasons are very straightforward. Chagas disease is actually caused by a very nasty bug, a literal little insect, and it lives in the cracks of substandard housing. So if you have housing that's not terribly clean, but more importantly, is not very sealed, open to the elements, and has lots of nooks and crannies like old housing, it loves that. So people who suffer from Chagas are going to be more likely to people who live in that substandard, shabbily built housing. And then there's, there's a question of nutrition and other issues. But then I think there will also be some diseases that turn out to be more democratic. And because, not every infection is stratified that way. So in general, you're absolutely right. But I think in particular, we may actually see some of these diseases become more prevalent in the middle class. And that's just my theory. I haven't actually found other scientists to say that. They're not really given to predicting that kind of thing anyway, but I think there's a good chance that although most of the people will be poor people of color, that there will also be other people who are affected in the U.S.
And how reliable do you think the studies are on infectious disease, tropical diseases, and human intelligence when they're using a parameter like IQ, which certainly is a controversial measurement of intelligence when it's going across cultures?
Yeah, I don't think of IQ as being controversial. I think of it as frankly flawed. IQ works well when you're looking at wealthy Western countries because it tends to measure the kind of things that are done frequently in Western countries. There's a lot of evidence that IQ measures not ability, but it measures activities, mental activities that are improved through repetition. And so if you're measuring people in the West who are frequently doing things like mathematical computations, you know, every day, I mean, simple ones, right? Making change, that sort of thing, then it's going to accurately measure it. But if you take that same measure and you go to Nigeria and deal with people who have a very different economy, who don't see perhaps money from one year to the next, and then ask a test that sort of predicates, you know, some familiarity with, you know, managing money or managing small, managing numbers, you're not going to get an accurate measure. The measures simply aren't accurate when you take them out of the U.S. Also, there are a lot of fiction around IQ. You know, one of the biggest fictions that the hereditarians, the people who say that it's hereditary, depend on is they say, well, it's genetic and it's passed on from generation to generation. That means that you can't increase IQ. And for them, in my opinion, it's a handy argument, because if your claim is that you can't increase IQ, then there's no need to, then you don't entertain suggestions that we should invest money in increasing it, right? It can't be done. But the reality, you know, the studies show us something different. In Kenya, IQ points rose 14 points over a very short period of time when people's health was improved. You know, they weren't different intellectually, they weren't differently genetically in the short period of time, but their health improved. And then their IQ went up. So IQ, we don't know what IQ measures, but it's certainly not raw intelligence. It's
right.
Measuring something different.
And lastly today, Harriet, how is infectious madness being received in the medical world? Are you getting a lot of pushback, or is this been a welcome reception from your colleagues?
Yes, you know, I've been very, very happy that the experts in the field, the people whose opinion I cared about the most, the people who do this sort of work, the neuroscientists, and not just the ones I spoke to. There was one in particular who I really wanted to interview, and I couldn't do it because his schedule was so busy. I didn't get to talk to him until after the book was essentially finished. And he raved about it, which made me very happy. They have praised not only the accuracy of the book, but they have praised the scope, because I not only describe things that for which there's hard data, I also describe things that are more speculative but are important avenues for research, important avenues for things that we should get more information about. Like, for example, how is the fear of infection tied to our penchant for violence? You know, why a lot of stranger violence? Why do we have stranger violence that coincides with maps of infection, that sort of thing? And they praised that. I was a little nervous about that. I didn't know how well that would be received, but they were very happy. What's interesting to me is that the experts in the field have said glowing things about the nuance of the book, as well as its factual nature. But it is the lay reviewers who occasionally, in like two occasions I can think of, who seem to have some difficulty understanding basic things I said in the book. For example, there was a review in the New York Times yesterday that surprised me, because the viewer wrote that I was claiming that infection causes mental illness, period. And I thought, that's interesting. In the first few pages, I specify that it's 10 to 15%. And I talk about all the other factors, genetics, you know.
It makes you wonder whether they read the book.
That was my first thought. How could you have read the book and not understood that? And one of the reviewers did the same thing. They wrote as if I was claiming that only infection. And I found that really surprising. I couldn't figure out whether they hadn't read the book, or perhaps whether this duality of mind, this like habit of thought I've talked about, sometimes hampers some people's understanding. You know, some people are tied to a binary view of things, like it has to be either or, either infection or psychosocial. They don't understand that it can be both. And of course, I said clearly it was both, so it was a little surprising.
Do you have a website you could point our listeners to?
Please excuse me. No, I'm working on it.
Okay.
I have to admit, things have been very busy, and I should have had it up by now.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you today, Harriet, and I hope people go out and get Infectious Madness. It's definitely a really interesting and provocative read.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you, Dave. Thank you for having me on your show.
We were talking today with medical ethicist and writer Harriet Washington, the author of Infectious Madness, The Surprising Science of How We Catch Mental Illness. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host, and this has been Health Watch.
And before we go to Madness Radio, let you know that there is a public hearing on that proposed Sorrows Savage Oil Terminal. Sorrows that will be held Tuesday. That's tomorrow. That will be held January 5th. That's tomorrow. From 1 p.m. until as late as 11 p.m. with a rally at 5 p.m. That is, the rally is at 5 p.m. The public hearing is from 1 p.m. until 11 p.m., and that is at the Clark County Event Center in Ridgefield, Washington. If you need more information on that, check upcoming events at 350pdx.org.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence Program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The goals of the KBOO Artist Support Program are to support and invest in individuals who are pushing themselves artistically using sound, whose work will impact the cultural landscape of Portland, and to bring those artists into the dynamic KBOO community of local, national, and international artists and activists. Applications for